Hello, and welcome to Agents of Impact, a podcast from Impact Alpha. I'm David Bank, editor and CEO, and I'm joined by my co-host and friend, Sherelle Dorsey, who has joined up as a contributing editor. Hi, Sherelle.
Hey, David. Good to be here.
We've been on our longest podcast break since Impact Alpha started putting out podcasts, I think back in 2015, but we're back. And it's great to have you with us as we restart these Agents of Impact interviews and conversations all across the landscape of impact investing, sustainable finance, and social entrepreneurship. I've really been loving your plugged in interviews on LinkedIn Live.
Thank you. They've been exciting. I think it's just exciting to have these conversations. And I'm glad. I'm glad that the podcast is back and we can really deep dive into so many of these really significant leaders and voices, in this space of impact.
Sherelle, we've been, fellow travelers since your days starting The Plug, and Impact Alpha has absorbed some of the assets and some of the great editorial and content from The Plug. What are you up to now besides continuing your work with us?
Yeah, absolutely. After stepping out of The Plug and really identifying what lessons have been learned and, in running a media company and doing some reporting, those things are still very part of my life. So, most recently, I'm still, developing research and insights. So for instance, me and Taylor James, who led research and data at The Plug, we still had the fortunate opportunity to work with Omidyar Network to release the Black Tech Effect Report covering...
I saw that, yeah.
Yeah, covering 100 promising Black tech startups across categories and industries. And then just personally, the entrepreneurial journey is such a very unique one. And I have been synthesizing a lot of my work under this moniker of simplifying the hustle and just, working a little bit more sustainably, no pun intended there. But really, really ramping up my own personal newsletter to share, tips and ideas and guides on just how do we kind of, do this great work and not kind of burn ourselves out in the process.
I love that. Simplify the hustle. And it is germane, obviously, because, as you know, and I know, and a lot of folks, you can't just keep pouring it out without replenishing. And I think that's relevant to Lenore Champagne Byrne, the conversation that you had. She's from Bright Ventures, and she works a lot to make sure that her entrepreneurs can live sustainably, as you
absolutely.
Say.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think it was such an interesting conversation, particularly because we're starting to see VCs take on this role of not just, hey, we're the money people and go make us more money, but also how do we support and ensure that you have what you need, be it through coaching or community, to also solve for some of the things that, as we know, just come up in running a business day to day, needing to find ways to get, new talent, or you need, consultants or contractors or just executive leadership skills, from running a day-to-day business. And so the conversation was really poignant as, Bright Ventures hyper focuses on companies that are building a more inclusive economy. And so I thought it was interesting as well that they take the holistic approach to impact investing and really looking at the whole person or the whole entrepreneur who is doing more than just running a company. Some are running families, some are running relationships. There's so much more than just I'm building a business.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to listening in on your chat with Lenore. I want to remind folks that this show is part of the Impact Alpha podcasting network, and you can find links to all of our shows on impactalpha.com. And while you're there, sign up for Impact Alpha Open, our free weekly newsletter, or better yet, become a full subscriber to Impact Alpha. And if you haven't yet subscribed to this podcast, do that as well and leave us a rating and a review so that others can find us. Okay, so now let's jump into Sherelle's interview with Lenore Champagne Byrne of Bright Ventures.
All right. Good afternoon and good morning to our friends on the West Coast. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. My name is Sherelle Dorsey. I'm a contributing editor here at Impact Alpha, and I'm really excited for this conversation today. We have the privilege of speaking with
Lenore Champagne Byrne, who's co-founder and managing partner of Bright Ventures. Today's conversation is going to really help us dive into not just the ethos around what Bright Ventures is doing around inclusive economy shaping, but also the necessity of firms that are hyper-focused on making sure that we're investing in the future. And the future really looks like a diverse group of founders instead of builders who typically have not had the chance or the opportunity to grow and to build. And we're going to reference some stats about that pretty soon here as well. Lenore, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. How are you?
I'm really well. Thank you, Cheryl. Great to be here.
So glad to have you. We got a chance to connect just a few short weeks ago, and it looks like we've known a lot of the same people in this world of startup ecosystem building, and especially with a firm and fund that's hyper-focused on supporting underrepresented founders. Lenore, can you tell us a little bit more about the foundations of Bright Ventures and really the mission behind the firm and what you've created here?
Yeah, sure. Happy to. So the mission at Bright Ventures is a big one. It's to build an inclusive economy. And I'm sure we'll talk more about what that means in general, what that means at Bright. And the big vision at Bright is to build an economy where every person can live in their fullest expression. We do that through capital, our venture capital fund that I know we'll spend some time on today, through community, where we bring together investors, operators, and innovators, and then through coaching, which is actually where Bright started. It's our genesis, and I think a really important underpinning of all of the work that we do.
Let's go back in time a little bit. So you've had a pretty interesting subset of experiences from management consulting to also working in investor outreach and a variety of skills. Why at this stage did you decide that you wanted to go and build a fund and then build a fund specifically with these kind of wraparound support services as well? Like what was the kind of ethos that led you to say, let me do this very, very hard task and build this thing?
Yeah, it's a great question and a great point. There are definitely easier ways to spend my time, but this mission at Bright is my life's work. And I'll take you back to 2014 to give you a real picture of how that came together. So actually, I'll take you back even further to lay a foundation. So my first job ever in the investing world was in Haiti, and I was working with a foundation. For that foundation, the Pan American Development Foundation, I was responsible for identifying, so sourcing, also evaluating, and then investing in business opportunities on the ground in Haiti. But for the foundation to deploy any of our philanthropic capital, we had to have our dollars matched by the private sector. That could be Haitian local banks through small business lending. It could also be emerging markets investors. And doing that work helped me realize that there was something really interesting for me, and also something I could really be impactful at, in helping communities connect with sources of capital and helping build an argument and a case for why community-generated solutions, so women-led ventures or Haitian-led innovation in Haiti, were exciting, appealing, and maybe overlooked by a traditional investor. What I learned from that experience in Haiti is more than we can cover in this time, but some of the key takeaways led to the creation of Bright. One, I learned that in order to reorganize how capital flows, we have to shift our mindsets and look at our implicit biases and our blind spots. And two, I learned that in order to make the real change I wanted to make, we had to connect people across networks that may be unfamiliar to them and move capital ourselves. And so you'll see all of those insights reflected in Bright's model. In 2014, I founded Bright Ventures as a strategic advisory firm and executive coaching company. We mostly focused on underrepresented innovators and investors. In 2019, we layered in the community strategy, where we started to connect those folks and partner with corporations and other groups to ensure that everyone had the resources and networks they needed. And then in 2021, we did a first close of our what is now Bright's Fund One, where we invest in early stage technology companies in financial tech, digital health, and the future of work.
That's an incredible story. I think most of us would not imagine a thread from Haiti and capital deployment and support services and building into where you are today. But I really love this thread and this theme, where it all still centers around inclusivity and really making these investments into what should be an inclusive future. I'd love to talk a little bit more about the transition from strategic advisement, community support, corporate partnerships, things like that, into that progression into the fund itself. Was it kind of as a result of working with these companies that you identified and saw that some of the gaps, yes, may have been those partner access to partnership opportunities, right, which we know are very central to business growth and building and opportunities, especially for underrepresented founders, and strategic planning, community, all of those things. But I guess from there, did you identify or see sort of any unique things that were happening where you saw that we need to solve this problem with more capital deployment, that we could see mm-hmm. more growth for these founders if they also had more access to capital? Would love to kind of hear about like that discovery and how that led to the fund itself.
Yeah, so an important stepping stone in my background was I did spend time at another venture capital fund based in New York that mostly focused on software and technology companies. And in that moment, I could see that venture capital, this was in 2015 to 17 or 14 to 16. In that moment, I could see that venture capital has the potential to fund the technologies that will shape the way we live and work. Venture is where new technology starts that will ultimately define how we experience so much of our lives. And I had sort of an aha moment that if I wanted to see technologies that actually reflected the life I wanted to live, it might mean a different sourcing function, a different underwriting criteria than existed in venture at that time. And so I dedicated a huge amount of my own time and attention to studying the gap and noticing, okay, on the surface, you could see like, we don't have a ton of women. We really don't have a ton of people of color. And we really, really don't have women of color leading ventures. 2014, 2016, you didn't see that happening. But as you dig deeper, you didn't see them on leadership in leadership roles on teams very frequently. We also very much didn't see products and services that that reflected the needs of these communities, which, as we know, are an emerging majority in our country. And so when you think about the fact that there's an emerging majority and you think about the dearth of diverse leadership in venture, you can hear that as sort of an injustice, which I see that and hear it. You can also see it as this is an amazing market opportunity, because if you can be a fund that understands underrepresentation and can underwrite to it in an effective way and support and back companies who are building for the consumers and companies of tomorrow, that's a really exciting value proposition. And so it was the combination of those insights that led me to this fund. Transparently, as I mentioned, first close of the fund that we're now investing was in 2021. I don't know that the market was ready for what I had to offer before then. And so that was part of the timing, was just like, when can what I see be heard by LPs and others to bring this vision to life?
Yeah, that's really smart and astute, because the timing has been, I think, a very unfortunate in terms of, I mean, part of it is like, yes, like we know that 2020 was really this interesting Black Swan event with the pandemic, and then we had the murder of George Floyd and this sort of new interest in all of these challenges that Black Americans were having across the country, across a variety of different sectors. And the venture capital space was not exempt from that. And we started to see the rise of more funds, more focus on the lack of diversity, as you referenced earlier, like very few women in these spaces, and then even fewer people of color. And so your timing definitely mirrors that of other funds that were able to be launched successfully and conversations and doors were opened up. But there's also this challenge of like, 21st century like progression, and we're still yes. having this conversation of the timing wasn't right, and that feeling both infuriating, but also understanding that there are so many different ways in which founders and founders of color and those attempting to do this work and addressing like major issues have been able to succeed despite some of these very significant odds. Yes. And I'm sure that just throughout your journey that you have seen folks do the workaround and do a whole lot with very little.
I absolutely have. And it is part of what gives me courage. As an executive coach, I work directly with a number of founders of color who have broken through all of the odds and barriers that have been a challenge for so many. And the burden and opportunity for me was to help people think about, how do you succeed in a system that's not built for you? How do you retain the you of it? How do you retain your health, your mental health? How do you retain the networks that are going to keep you and your company moving? And how do you build a case, again, in an environment that's not built to hear you? Those, first of all, huge privilege to be trusted by the founders who I've had the opportunity to work with as a coach over the last decade. And also certainly a privilege to be able to apply some of those questions and answers in my own life and journey as I've built Bright.
Lenore, I wanna go back into some of the mission orientation of Bright Ventures. And you spoke to something that I think a lot of us talk about but don't really understand when we talk about supporting founders who are really solving big, meaty issues. I'm sure we could have laundry lists expanding of all the things that need to be solved for in society. And then we also know that sometimes you solve one problem and then kind of four or five others pop up that you have to solve for. So the work is always having to be done. What do you all look for specifically in the founders that you all are supporting and investing in? And I know that, you know, you all have like such an incredible array of portfolio companies right now that you've already deployed capital to, but would also love to know like which ones you're really excited about as well.
Yes. So to answer that question, I will give you a brief overview of the inclusive innovation model that underpins all the work that Bright does across our three strategies: the capital, the coaching, and the community. So through academic research and lots now of professional experience, we have identified, developed, and then really refined three pillars that we look for across and aim to work in across all of our efforts at Bright. The first is we believe fundamentally that healthy leaders build healthy companies. And so we always seek to invest in, partner with, and develop the mental and physical well-being of anyone we come into contact with. The second is that the second big assertion of our model is that organizations can be defined and designed for connection and collaboration to their benefit. And so this idea that like, you actually, yes, you can design for inclusion. It is a business process that you can design for. And then third, we look for partnership with companies that are stakeholder oriented. So it's really important to us that the founder understand the end user. So even if it's a B2B to C, we want to make sure that the founder has some experience and proximity to the C who will ultimately use that product, the consumer. And that's important to us because of something that we said earlier, Sherelle, which is if we want to see products and services that actually meet the needs of the individual, right? We need to have founders and businesses aligned to that effort. So those are some of the things we look for. As I mentioned, Bright Ventures invests at pre-seed and seed. So at that stage, you're not going to see a fully expressed business model across those pillars. You're not going to have a huge team. You're not going to have a ton of customer data. But what we found is that there's a tremendous amount that you can evaluate, even at pre-seed, in the way the founder conceives of, understands, and interacts with their target market. And so we have a deep evaluation around that. It's a leadership assessment that we developed actually now several years ago that we use as a diligent step for all of our investments at Bright. You asked another question, what companies are we excited about? So many. I'm actually incredibly excited about each of the companies that we've invested in. And there are vastly different reasons, but a few that I'll highlight now. I'm incredibly proud of one of our founders, Maya Hartigan, and her co-founder, Alicia, at May. May is a maternal health equity company that addresses the well-being of Black mothers who are giving birth. And Maya was recently actually invited to the White House to address the vice president on this very important issue. Maya's prototypical of the kind of founders we get excited about in that she's a Black mother of three beautiful daughters. She has that proximity. She also spent over a decade, I think it was 14 years at Pfizer commercializing digital health innovations. So she's got that operating experience that can inform how she brings this product to market. And she understands the broader stakeholders. So she understands health systems. She understands Medicaid. And she recognizes the big, big influences that shape the experience, the maternal health experience for Black mothers, and can move that forward. So when you, I'm trying to connect your two questions. That's one we're really excited about. It's also one that I think, again, is sort of prototypical of what we get excited about at Bright.
That's really incredible. I definitely have to check out May. Again, that's M-A-E, correct?
It's M-A-E. That's right. Mm-hmm.
Super, super incredible. But I also think about the idea that you all are betting early on these companies who are in that like prototype phase. They are figuring out their target customer. They're really like refining their business model in order to get to the next level, to do another raise, to hire a team or what have you. And that executive coaching component to me is really fascinating. I've been a founder. I have lots of founder friends within this ecosystem. And I always find that we are actually just started becoming a coach for another founder who's building a really incredible kind of ad-based social media tool. And I find that we don't have so much emphasis on going from founder to CEO because that world changes so quickly and so drastically, especially when you go from doing every single thing alone or maybe with a co-founder and you kind of wear many hats to now you're having to hire, you're having to make decisions around partnerships, you're having to bring in someone to run HR, you're having to have someone to come in to really create systems and processes so that as you scale, you're starting to be removed from the nitty and the gritty of the everyday building of the business and doing what you're supposed to do as CEO, which is like keeping money in the door, ensuring that you're getting great team members on the team, you're representing the company, you're the face. There's such a tremendous transition that can happen very quickly. And a lot of times founders aren't prepared. And I think that's where we start to see these headlines of like CEOs gone wrong or gone wild. And so I love that there's still this aspect of the earlier work that you all started with Bright Ventures in terms of that advising, that coaching or what have you. And I want to recognize that we're in a really weird time in this space. I know that we are all feeling it, be it from the venture side, from the startup ecosystem to just the day-to-day economic climate of the tech world and kind of where things are. I'm curious to learn from you, as you all are supporting founders, what they are saying or believing are some of their kind of greatest challenges as they are growing and as they are trying to move into those next phases of their business.
Mm. One of the things that I think is that I'm grateful for as I lead Bright's fund is that we have so much executive coaching experience. And so we can listen through what founders say, because what I observe is that founders will language the challenges differently, but with some pattern recognition across the decade of executive coaching experience we have at Bright, we can say, okay, I think I have seen this before. And it sounds like one of these. I will also note that we have found that there's different sort of founder archetypes that we tend to work with. But one thing that many of them have in common is that they are what I call over owners. Like they have needed to be so committed to excellence in their outputs and in their final results that they have adopted a whatever it takes attitude. Sometimes to the detriment of their own mental health well-being, they will stay up many, many a sleepless night to get things done. Sometimes they will drive results through others, but in ways that may be unsustainable. And so at Bright, we do an evaluation that I mentioned earlier at the top of our relationship with the founder. It gives us a baseline. It helps us say, all right, given that it might be one of those, what can we predict might go wrong at a Series A? What kind of support might we introduce to ensure that this founder can see something coming and things don't blindside them? And then we actually have quarterly check-ins to ensure that we're sort of proactively supporting founders with the things that they need. Beyond that, there are always emergencies. And so, you know, an investor will pull out, or a customer will churn unexpectedly, or a key team member won't be who we hoped they would turn out to be. And so in those moments, the coaching staff at Bright is able to step in what we call emergency calls. So that's a bit of how we approach it. It's, I would assert, and I believe it's more robust on the coaching side than most funds. And that's, again, because we have the benefit of a whole coaching firm that's dedicated not only to Bright's portfolio, but to a broad set of other clients. But I think in general, if I look at the patterns, what I'm seeing is founders who are so good at creating certain outcomes that they don't want to let go of control of certain parts of their business as it scales. They're fearful that they'll disappoint investors or other stakeholders. And Sheryl, you started to point to like, okay, at founder level, that might be good, but at CEO level, is that really going to get you what you need? We also, in some cases, see founders who I think really are able to drum up a ton of motivation and confidence in themselves, but sometimes then get disconnected from like, let's evaluate the downside risk and understand the more conservative scenario as well. And so sometimes we spend more time sort of asking them to actually be more on the ground. So there's a pretty wide range, but across the founders that we've worked with and certainly that I see in our portfolio, there are big concerns about how do I make sure that my company not just raises a round, but has enough funding to prove the next big point that I need to prove in order to get us to the next level? How do I attract, recruit, and retain the absolute best in class talent for this venture and talent that covers my blind spots as you evolve from founder to CEO? And then I think as well, how do I ensure that I'm in the right rooms and in the right conversations to sell this thing to whomever it might be, health systems, banks, corporations are the most often at Bright. So on balance, that's basically the stuff that we hear a lot of.
I really appreciate that. That was just very, very thorough and definitely mirrors a lot of the challenges and big questions that I had during my entrepreneur journey. And I'm sure for many of folks who are joining us here in the room today as well, that transition can be really, really tough. And a lot of times, you know, having an investor relationship where there is open and honesty and transparency, where you can come to, you know, to your investors and say, hey, I'm having this issue or I need help working through this. Those kinds of support services also, I think, help to support some of the positive aspects of having a successful company, right? Mm-hmm. You're able to ask for that help. And I don't want to overlook how significant that component is, especially mm-hmm. for underrepresented founders, especially when we think through, when we just think through the various challenges that can exist, no matter what industry you might be building in, those relationships right. are really, really significant. I do want to pivot us sort of back to addressing the funding and capital needs to founders of color. I want to talk about this deployment because I have to keep putting forth the data. I think that especially in the climate that we're in now, where there are particularly funds that have been attacked by groups, like the Fearless Fund, as we know, has been, you know, sort of this front-facing fiasco mm-hmm. of being sued for not being diverse because they do provide grants and support to Black founders. There's this idea from some of these groups that funds and services and resources that are built for groups that have historically been excluded are not diverse in their diversity. And so we know that's a really challenging time right now, but I want to continue to hit on the fact that why like a firm like Bright Ventures exists and is necessary. So this summer, McKinsey put out a report looking at the total funding received across stages of startup companies. For the highest funded startups at the time, their exits revealed that white male founders received over $210 million in funding, while the average startup of an underrepresented founder received a mere 43% of that, or just $91 million. So we're looking at like the reality of creating a business, having to hire, having to build companies or what have you, but specifically because you are not white or male, it can completely change the economics of the opportunities that you have to continue to grow your business. And so I would love to, I'd love to kind of hear from you, Lenore, especially as you mentioned, the gatherings you have with other Black fund managers as well, and the conversations of there's still a great deal of work to be done. And even as the interest in kind of the DE&I space has waned since 2020 and 2021, I'd love to get your perspective on this ongoing necessary work and just even the sentiment that you all are kind of getting as like Black fund managers on how we still continue forward, even amid these like frivolous lawsuits, as well as, you know, potentially some of the pullback in capital deployment, just even to funds like Abright Ventures.
Sure. So I will first address Bright's thesis in this area just for clarity, and then speak to what I see as a larger shift in the market. So at Bright, we don't have a demographic mandate in terms of the founders we invest in. Our mandate is to invest in companies that close market gaps in large industries, legacy industries, healthcare, financial services, employment at large, right? We do future of work. And we do that based on the thesis that leaders who understand how to get new and the full spectrum of people engaged in those industries are going to outperform. This is based on shifts, demographic shifts in our market, right? We're more diverse than we've ever been as a country, and increasingly so. It's also based on psychographic shifts. So more and more you hear consumers, investors, workers, leaders in general saying, I want to work somewhere that aligns with my values. I want to participate in something that aligns with who I am and the world I want to see. That's a really complicated market for leaders to lead in. And we believe that if you can locate the leaders who have a plan for leading in this complicated, highly fragmented and polarized market, and who can sell into these huge industries, that's a winning strategy. While we don't have demographic qualifiers, the vast majority of the founders that we've backed today are underrepresented founders, meaning people of color and women. I clarify that just to ensure that folks understand where Bright is. And in terms of the Fearless Fund and the numerous attacks that we continue to see on sort of Black leaders in general, I'm not a lawyer, so I can't speak to the strategy of it, but I have heard and seen that it results in some pullback from investors who were motivated by the potential of DEI in 2020, but feel more cautious today when they're unsure of how their capital will land, how it will be interpreted, and sort of the politics of it all. I guess what I encourage investors, sort of LP investors, to do is think about maybe like setting aside for a moment the moral argument around it, what it means to be a fiduciary in the market that we exist in today. Given the data that women-led ventures are more capital efficient, given the data that under diverse leadership, companies go further and outperform, how is your investment strategy built for that truth? How is your investment strategy built for the vastly diverse demographics that we have in our country today? And so again, setting aside the, is it the right thing? Is it not the right thing? How are you being responsible with the capital you have? And how can we ensure that we're not falling prey to narratives that really don't have data behind them and that are set, that are here just to create destruction and confusion? So that is broadly how I'm seeing the market react. I do think it's going to be a really challenging time for Black fund managers like myself and many others. And I'm hopeful about our ability to work together to continue to build firms that meet the market we have.
I really appreciate that feedback and remarks, Lenore. I wanna go ahead, it looks like we're starting to get some questions here piled up. So I wanna make sure we leave some time here to address them. And thank you all for dropping your questions here in the comment sections. We'll try to get to as many as we can. Sean Bennett, thank you so much for your question here. Sean Bennett asks, as Bright Ventures has some experience so far funding underrepresented founders, have you experienced a longer runway for building and scaling them that doesn't come into play for broader founder groups?
Yes. So I want to be careful not to paint underrepresented founders as a monolith. There is a lot of different, there are a lot of different ways that underrepresented founders come to market. And as a generalization, I do often calculate the potential impact of implicit bias into how we see a company's journey. So we know that women spend longer in market. We know that women of color, let alone Black women, really spend longer in market to raise the funds they need, and we raise less. So yes, often runway is an important consideration. To be specific at Bright, we have a two-part strategy around this. So at pre-seed, we will take a more significant portion of ownership in a company and really dig in. There are founders we meet with weekly or even more to get them to sort of the next round of funding. We tend to preview our companies with potential follow-on investors or co-investors way before they need capital. And we also tend to co-invest with some of our limited partners or the investors in Bright's fund. I find that at Bright, we've found a pretty happy sort of community of folks who get the theme and thesis behind our work. And so we lean into that as we continue to support and build and scale the ventures we work with. But for underrepresented founders, particularly in a slower market, I encourage you to assume, like look at your model and see what happens if it takes double as long to sell what you think you'll sell and double as long to fundraise, and look at what, see what comes up around what creative solutioning is possible if you want to continue down the path of building your firm in light of the challenges.
I want to go to Mwema Lombe's question here, particularly on the data analytics part. And I love the reference around, you know, not getting distracted or, you know, completely disoriented through so much of the rhetoric that we're hearing, but actually looking at data. So I thought this was a really apropos question that Wemma asks, which is, how does Bright Ventures utilize data and analytics in making its investment decisions?
Sure. So some of this is really, I think, ventures convention, and then some of it's less so. So I'll take you through the conventional pieces more quickly, because I think they're quite common to venture. So we certainly look at the key performance indicators of a company. Those, of course, vary by stage. So we're looking at things like revenue. We're looking at the number of contracts you have, the average contract size. We're looking at the length of a sales cycle, particularly if you're selling into enterprise. In consumer companies, we're looking at how many weekly and monthly active users or daily active users you have, how frequently they're coming into the app, how long they spend. So those key performance indicators, I think, are quite consistent. When you zoom out, of course, we're looking at how the broader market that the startup plays in is performing. And so we want to see that you're playing in a market where there is enough money to access, like a big enough market to make your company interesting in size for venture capital, but also that there's enough room for innovation or doing something new that you could actually create a compelling enough value proposition to attract some of that capital to your company. We track those things on a quarterly at minimum basis in the companies that we invest in. In terms of the things that are less conventional, I mentioned our leadership assessment at Bright. We have a rubric that has 46 points on it. We score it as we're meeting a founder, and it helps us understand and ground ourselves in some baseline evaluation of the founder's orientation toward their own well-being, the founder's orientation toward team and collaboration, and then toward their stakeholder group. I took you through that inclusive innovation model earlier. That rubric is also refreshed quarterly with a major refresh annually, because founders learn and change through coaching and other tools. And so that sort of keeps us on track on both the business side and on the founder and team development side of the companies we work with.
One of our last questions here from Nova Phoenix. So Nova asks, are you open to solo entrepreneurs at your firm? So solo founders, it sounds like. And then what characteristics have you identified that makes a great VC or founder relationship work? I really love that second part of that question.
Yeah, me too. So the first one's easy. Yes, the answer is yes. It's even more important, though, that you've got the self-awareness to build the right team around you at that point. But I'm a solo GP. I founded Bright Ventures alone. I'm also, so it would be a bit hypocritical of me to say that I don't think solo founders can excel. On the second question, in terms of the characteristics, I mean, I think you have to look at Does the, so if we assume for a moment that capital is commodified as a founder, like you can go get cash in lots of different ways. And then you're evaluating which way is the way that will get me the outcomes I want for my company. I think it's important to look at least two big categories. One is, does the firm have a demonstrated history of excellence in the kind of company that you are building? Do they have, can they call the kinds of customers that you want to talk to, or can they call investors who could follow on in your next round? I'll just make a quick side note. If you're an underrepresented founder and you got pre-seed or seed funding, there are less diversity focused funds at like Series A and beyond. And there are not none, but there are fewer. And so I encourage you to think about later stage investors early. Okay, coming back. So you want investors who can practically support you. But at least as importantly, and maybe more importantly, you want an investor who really hears you when you speak and who you really hear when they speak, so that you actually have a productive working relationship. Not every investor on your cap table is going to be your first call. It's not possible, but make sure that you have someone who you feel really comfortable calling with the messy parts, right? Like, we've got founders at Bright who will call us because they've lost a loved one and they're actually trying to navigate through grief as they sort out how to complete some important sales, or who are thinking about letting go of a team member that was a really big part of how they pitched the company. Like, that messy stuff, you got to be able to bring to at least one of your investors. And so I encourage you to find folks who you feel comfortable with. I hope that's supportive. And thanks for that question too.
Yeah, I think that's always a great question. And that's also part of that CEO building, right? From founder into the tough work of the CEO, some of that invisible work and that relationship with our investors and other support folks is really, really critical. Lenore, I just want to say thank you for joining us in the conversation today. And Lenore, what's the best way for people to follow your work, follow Bright Ventures, and get in touch if they have any questions or are just even interested in potentially, becoming a portfolio company one day?
Sure. So please follow us on LinkedIn on the Bright Ventures page. You're also welcome to follow me. And then our website has a form. We aim to be reachable for founders. So our website has just an open form on the fund page where you can submit what you're working on. And like, it comes to my email, so I will see it. I'm happy to meet you that way as well.
Thank you again, Lenore.
Thank you, Sherelle. Take great care.
Take care, you too.
Wow, Sherelle, that was terrific. I was really impressed by Lenore's very practical kind of approach to supporting entrepreneurs. I'm sure it's something that a bunch of other VCs could take a lesson from.
Yeah, I think so. I think we're starting to see this narrowing gap of, VCs, again, looking really holistically at the entrepreneur experience and really providing a lot more resources. And dare I say, just, more than metrics, right? Like, really looking at how they can leverage their time and networks to help entrepreneurs along this journey.
Yeah, exactly. So more than metrics and simplify the hustle. Thanks for bringing that to us, Sherelle. We'll be bringing you more conversations with agents of impact. And you can see all the shows in the Impact Alpha podcasting network at impactalpha.com. And make sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.